As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine and I'm delighted to be joined today by John McKenzie. Hi, John.
Hi, Joe.
Yes, and to my left here, two fabulous guests, as ordinarily here, not ordinary person, but as is ordinarily here, it's Seb Stafford-Blore. Hi, Seb.
Hi, Joe. That was really well done. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Nice. Very smooth.
Yes.
And we're all, I'm sure, I can speak for all of us, delighted to welcome Mr. Michael Bailey, The Athletic's Norwich City writer, and during the tournament, spending a lot of time with TIFO, Michael.
Yes, I'm just here. Just loitering.
You're just loitering.
For the World Cup.
It's working out well for you, isn't it?
I am. Well, here I am. Yeah. It took you 5 days? 6 days. What day is it?
Seven.
It's day seven.
Even worse.
Well, there we go. Michael Bailey's here, and we're pleased about that. Lots to discuss today. We've just watched Argentina win a game. So that's interesting. Australia won all game. Also very, very impressive that was. We'll come to talk about that. France too won Denmark. And of course, the Saudi Arabia-Poland game happened earlier too. We're going to ask Michael some general questions about the tournament a little bit later on. And we're going to play Points Are Bad. What was your favourite thing about the day, John?
My favourite thing about the day was hanging out with Michael Bailey.
Right. That's, I mean, I tell you what, the perfect segue is available there, because if you want to hang out with Michael Bailey, albeit in written form, then you can do that by visiting theathletic.com/TIFO, theathletic.com/TIFO, where you can find all of Michael's excellent writing. And if you're not a Norwich City fan or don't care about them at all, there are plenty of other writers who write about other teams, although you will be missing out on Michael's superb work, I have to say.
It's fine.
Yeah. Check in from now and then, even if you're not a Norwich fan, though, I should say. Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah. And if you're a supporter of the US men's national team, you'll find Michael Bailey talking about Josh Sargent a lot. And we'll speak about him later, won't we?
Oh, yes, please.
Yes, please. Exactly.
The Athletics, Josh Sargent, World Cup correspondent.
Official title.
Yeah. Is he?
Yeah. No, that's
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wow, that should have been the advert.
It's kind of live information, though. It's more fun that way.
Who else have they got? They've got a few other columnists, haven't they, The Athletic, for the World Cup?
Yeah, they've got Yaya Toure. Jesse Marsh is a columnist, your favourite, John. Mauricio Pochettino is a columnist.
Oh.
Yeah, there's loads of great ones.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yaya Toure was a columnist for the Euros as well and wrote that excellent article about players using their bums in football.
Yeah, we converted that into a video. It did. Yeah. People seem to enjoy that, which is great. It was a very, very good piece of work.
There you go. Well, anyway, that's The Athletic. So go and sign up there. You can get currently a very exciting deal of £1 per month for 6 months. So you can try it out for virtually nothing. TheAthletic.com/TIFO. TIFO. Yes. But for now, ladies and gentlemen, I'll leave you in the warm hands and the oh-so-cool, crystal-cool embrace of Mr. Michael Bailey. Yes. Okay, where else to start but Argentina 2-0 Mexico. Now, it's nice that Argentina got a win, John, but around 80 minutes into this game, you said, and I quote, "I'm starting to think that Argentina aren't the favourites for this tournament." Why did you say that?
Yeah, it's not been a great tournament for them so far. I suppose it's only been two games, but yeah, they lost to Saudi Arabia and struggled, I think, in large parts of the game today against Mexico. And I think a lot of that has got to do with the way that they've approached this game. So on the board, in front of me, I usually say that over there, but I'm saying it here today. Mm. I've got the Argentina team set up. They played in a 4-4-2 diamond today. So we call that a 442 diamond because, let me draw the lines on. We've got a little diamond here in the midfield, but obviously what this does is it makes the pitch quite narrow. So we've got areas here and here where there's no coverage.
And of course, by here and here, you mean in the wide areas?
No, actually, no.
Oh.
No, yeah, I do.
No, really. He does mean
I just wanted to make you look
even silly. More torture for the listeners to this podcast.
Yes. So it's a very narrow formation, and so it means that you are compromised on either side. Obviously, Argentina are going to try and get through the middle because they have Lionel Messi as their important player, one of the greatest players to ever have lived, if not the greatest. So they wanted to get through the middle, but Mexico, I think they were quite smart in how they approached this game because they sat a little bit deeper. They went in a 3-5-2 formation, and they overloaded in the central areas because so much of what Argentina were going to try and do was get the ball through the middle. Messi's the most dangerous player. If you can keep the central areas clagged up, then you'll struggle to score. What was happening in build up was as well something that JJ mentioned on. Let me get rid of these lines. JJ mentioned on Twitter during the game actually is that during build up, so you've got Messi dropping as like a 10, and then you have these two midfielders here. Guido Rodriguez is playing as a pivot player, but actually what was happening in build up is that the two centre backs were splitting and he was dropping in here. Then you've got your two full backs, neither of whom are particularly actually dangerous in wide areas as well. So you're giving up space in wide areas, but you don't have any particularly dangerous players in those wide areas. And so the problem then becomes is that if it's not working out through the middle and you try and go down the wide area into the wide channels, you don't necessarily have the sorts of players who are going to cause problems for fullbacks. Now, Mexico are in a back five, so they've got wing backs dropping quite deep.
Yeah.
So they're making sure that they're essentially isolating out these two players, and then it means that you've got to go through the middle. Now, Rodriguez, one of the midfielders, already dropped in between the two centre backs, so you're already emptying your midfield in some sense. And then what we were seeing then was because McAllister and De Paul were here, that they were sometimes trying to get further forward and to help
they
out
were
in
sort
the
of
attack.
Free eights in this.
Yes,
sense,
exactly. Right, yeah. But that means that you've got no pivot player, and actually, what started happening was Messi was dropping into that. Into this hole here. So you've got the situation now where you're trying to get through the middle because your most dangerous player is Lionel Messi.
Yeah.
But Lionel Messi is actually helping you progress the ball. So
he's almost as far back as the defenders.
Yeah, exactly. So it is problematic because you're trying to build up through the middle. You have to do it quite quickly, I think, to make any sort of dangerous scenario against this sort of setup. Mm. They don't have the sort of players who are able to do that. In the end, Messi starts dropping deep to help progress the ball. And obviously the game turns with Messi scoring from outside the box. Just an incredible elite finish that we know Messi can do, but that you don't really want to be in a situation where you're relying on Messi having to pull out a shot from outside the box to score. So lots of issues really with them in terms of the tactical side of things. I'm sorry that I talked for a long time, but I feel as though that context is kind of important to the way that they're playing.
No, it is for sure, because I mean, you know, I think we could see these problems in Argentina's built up in the first half, Seb. When Messi did score a goal, it seemed to be perhaps the most efficient form of goal you can imagine.
Yeah, it reminded me of his goal from the 2011 Champions League final at Wembley, where it was 1-1 at the time, and it's kind of Manchester United were kind of packing the box a little bit, and he just bursts into space and punches a finish.
Yeah,
it's that injection of it's not injection of class is a bit of a cliche. It's a little bit of urgency, and it's a gear change in the match that just catches defenders unaware. And I was kind of hoping for a better performance tonight and a better game and a little bit more, more opportunity. At the same time, I quite enjoy when Messi just takes control of a game and decides something, just because it's a really nice framework for, in my opinion, the greatest player of all time. And to see him do that, to see him settle something, to see also the way his teammates respond to him, the way the crowd responds to him. I think there are, the reports are that there were 88,000 people in the stadium this evening. It's kind of, if this is his final World Cup, there's something righteous about those moments happening within that, because that's what you want from Messi. We all want a free-flowing Argentina, and we've certainly over the years seen a Messi-dependencia Argentina where there's nothing that works apart from him, really. And that was kind of, this was a little bit of a callback to it. But I enjoyed it just for John's response to it, glee, jumping up, celebrating. Mm. But I think that's what you want. I mean, Argentina are a story because of Messi, because this is the culmination of his international career. This might be the last chance. They've gathered all these competent pieces around him. There's a system that has worked, not so far in this tournament, I might add, but for much of Lionel Scaloni's reign, and that's what you want. That is the Messi you want to see on the biggest stage of them all. So yeah. I enjoyed it. And also, like, you talked about like it being an efficient finish, and I think that's right, because there's no trickery. There's nothing in that only Messi can do. It's just the timing. So it's the knowledge and the understanding of this is what the situation needs. This is the space that I can burst into. And no matter how old he gets, he has the awareness to do that. And I think that's a really understated aspect of his greatness.
Yeah. Michael Bailey, Messi, not Josh Sargent. Let's, you know, so we'll get that
that's
out of
fine.
The way.
Yes.
But, and you know, at his age, as Seb described, I mean, he kind of did take control of this game, but he doesn't do that as often now as he did in his prime. But he's still fun to watch, isn't he?
Yeah, and you feel like he's still got the responsibility on his shoulders that he has to be at the level that he always was. I mean, it's the precision as well in that goal, because the shot is so close to being blocked, and the precision of the first touch is wonderful. And I just love the goal celebration. That sight, I just thought was beautiful. I really want him. I don't really care about Lionel Messi necessarily, but I just really want him to do well in this tournament, and therefore Argentina to do well. And just the sight of him looking up at the Argentinian fans in that moment was just wonderful. And it feels like the rest of the team were quite disjointed, and almost there was an issue with the coaching. But can we say that because they've done so well up until this point? You know, certainly before the World Cup, in terms of being unbeaten for 30 odd games, whatever it was, you know, surely they are pretty well functioning up until this point. But yeah, the more responsibility Messi takes, you know, and then the more successful it is, the better the narrative.
And the happier we all are. Now, John, you told us before what the problems for Argentina are in build-up, but you didn't directly address the idea that they might not be favourites. I mean, they have 3 points on the board now. We'll come to talk later about how difficult this group is going to be going into the third game. What are your overall expectations for them now, having seen them play, you know, not brilliantly in the first half, but get the result?
Yeah, I mean, it's not even certain that they're going to get through the group at this point. Yeah. So that's going to be the first thing on their minds. We'll see how that goes in the final group game. But once you get out of the group, you're then into this knockout stage where obviously it's not a lottery, but you are reliant on things happening. And I think if you're a team who is scoring a lot, that's fine, because even if you have defensive mishaps, which will happen in games, you will feel as though you can rectify those at the other end. Whereas the issue with this Argentina team has been that they've not been able to move the ball forward comfortably enough to get any kind of volume of dangerous chances. I mean, I can't even think of any like really dangerous chances in this game. And I think that's a much better indicator for the teams that are more likely to do well in the knockout stages. So it's worrying for Argentina, I think, because as I've said, they just seem so much weighted towards being a team who is going to play through the central areas. They don't have any difference makers in wide areas who can come up in these 1v1 situations and cause opposition players problems. And if you have that, then it just gives you another element to the way that you play. Especially at the international level, where everyone likes to block the center and force people out wide and say, go and do something in the wide areas. And then if you earn a goal, then you earn a goal. But this Argentina team to me seems quite one dimensional, and it doesn't have a huge amount of scope to offer any other dimensions from here on in as well. So, I think that's why for me, I'm feeling a little bit lower on them than I was before the tournament started.
Okay. Seb, Michael mentioned Argentina's coach, Lionel Scaloni. Yeah. I didn't know that much about him beforehand. He's quite young, 44 years old. Tell me a little bit about him and where he came from.
Well, truth be told, Joe, I don't think as a coach, anybody knew that much about him prior to 2018. He used to play for West Ham. He was a fullback in his playing career.
Wow. West Ham player as the manager of Argentina.
West Ham player. So basically, after Argentina were knocked out of the 2018 World Cup in Russia, do you remember they got beaten by that France team with the game of amazing goals with all the wonderful strikes, but they were a bit of a mess and they're eliminated. In the aftermath, Lionel Scaloni took over with Pablo Aimar. Do you remember him from Valencia?
Yes.
And from Championship Manager in the 90s? Mm-hmm. Yeah. They took over as kind of caretakers. Lionel Scaloni eventually gets a job. Pablo Aimar is still there. He you might see some interesting footage of him on social media this evening, of him sort of suffering through the moments before and after the Messi goal. But Scaloni got the job really because the Argentinian Football Association didn't have the money to appoint someone who was better qualified. And Scaloni had no senior coaching experience when he took over. And yet, he led them on this amazing run, which culminated in them winning the Copa America and remaining unbeaten, as Michael pointed out a couple of minutes ago, for over 30 games. So it's an amazing story. And it's actually, I was talking to Jack Collins from the Ranks podcast about this last week. It's interesting that you have that coach at this point in Messi's career, when perhaps like the valuable ingredient is actually a little bit of humility in someone who doesn't have the big reputation, someone who isn't Sampaoli, for instance, who doesn't stand for something very specific in the game, who is still learning his trade and is kind of really bending himself around the players at his disposal. So it's a really interesting story. Mm. It's not unheard of, because sometimes I always think of Roberto Di Matteo at Chelsea when he led them to the Champions League. Sometimes what you need is somebody who is a little bit deferential. And I don't know if that reflects on, if that's a fair description of him, but it certainly seems to have worked ahead of this tournament. And okay, so hasn't gone quite to plan so far, but they are just a game away from qualifying from knockout stages. And if they get there, they will still be among the favourites, whether they play particularly well or not, just on the sheer weight of ability they have. And so you have to respect what Scaloni's done, I think.
Yeah.
It's worth saying that he did seem to panic between the two games.
Yeah, I agree.
He made, I think, five changes between the two starting 11s. And I think brought on players in this game who maybe wouldn't have suited it as much as some of the players from the earlier games.
Can we say that's panicking, though? I mean, if you lose to Saudi Arabia in your opening...
There must be a huge pressure on you to not panic, but react to that.
Well, yeah, but like, is it fair to call it panicking? Maybe it's assertive changes.
I think so. Insofar as if you look at the underlying numbers for that game, you'll say we performed perfectly well enough to win that game.
Right.
Now, there was obviously issues that needed working on, a lot of which we've talked about already. But in terms of just sort of tearing up the copybook and bringing on different players to fit into the team, I think that's when it starts looking a little bit panicky, when you've just gone through, as we've talked about, a really long 35 games unbeaten streak, and then at the first sign of something not quite going right, then being like, oh, I'm gonna panic at this in this situation and try and affect change by bringing in different players rather than saying, look, we played well, let's go and do the same thing again, maybe make a few tweaks for the game. But it doesn't feel like that. It feels like for like players being like, well, this player didn't work so well, let's try another player who plays in the same position and see if it works.
Well, Michael Bailey, we spend a lot of time here, and the football media in general spends a lot of time talking about the coaching and how the players performed on the pitch and, you know, what they should have done differently and better and stuff, but we spend a little bit less time thinking about the sort of psychological element of playing football, being a footballer, being at a World Cup, being on the biggest stage, maybe it being your last one, maybe it being your first one. You know, that's hard, isn't it? It's hard to remember that they're all human beings.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it is a different level at this, at a tournament like this, isn't it? When you think of
a
player that yes, indeed, exactly that. It's to have the level of expectation, and I suppose, I mean, it's similar with Neymar, isn't it? Like, everything is just encapsulated into these games, and you know, believe even if you get injured, you're going to come back within a week and everything will be fine, just because there's so much, almost entire careers resting on this. Messi knows that he's kind of had this expectation that he would help Argentina win the World Cup at some point, because what is he if he doesn't? He's nothing. Well, he's not nothing, but, you know, he's a brilliant player. But it's almost like that validation is needed. And I think, again, it comes back to the sort of responsibility as well. You can just see the weight he's carrying around with him. But also, I guess the teammates, they know that. They no doubt love him. They think he's brilliant. They want to do it for him as much as their families, as much as for themselves. And then you go out and you lose the first game where no one expected you to. And also, you haven't experienced losing in 36, 37 games, whatever it is. You know, that's, and you've got like 4 days to deal with it. And also, you're still trying to get to grips with being at a World Cup and preparing with no lead up time to it. So there's so many things that as players you're having to deal with. And then lots of people look at it and go, well, that was a bit rubbish, or that was great. So, you know, but that scrutiny is obviously something they're dealing with themselves, but that there is a lot for them to process. And that is why you then see Messi do that, because he's basically unlocked a game that was drifting away from Argentina. And you just think, wow, that's just a brilliant moment for you.
Do you think that kind of accentuates that sort of moment? There's, when Messi's gone, when he retires, I'll miss the sound of Messi scoring goals for Argentina and the way people respond to it. But it was still like, Michael hits the nail on the head. It's almost like that he's had two parallel careers. What he's done for Barcelona and latterly for Paris Saint-Germain, but who he's been the Argentinian national team, but also to the people of Argentina. Because there's always been that kind of, is he Catalan, is he Argentinian, that discussion.
Yeah.
And so when he delivers in a moment like that, it feels very powerful, I think.
Yeah.
And it heightens the spectacle.
Yeah. It's fascinating, isn't it? Okay. Well, listen, that's Argentina. Well, I'm sure we'll be speaking about them again next week. Let's have a quick word on Mexico, Seb, who I wouldn't describe them as disappointing in this game. I thought they played fairly well. But I suppose 1 point after two games is not what they would have wanted.
No, and frustratingly, it's kind of what people predicted for Mexico, which is that they don't have a goal scorer and they're not going to score goals.
Yeah,
I was a little bit disappointed in Mexico because I look at the lineup and there are some interesting players there. I've liked what I've seen from Vega. I hadn't seen very much of him prior to this tournament, but I think he's a good player. I felt like it got a bit agricultural from Mexico at times. I felt like they played down. They created a bit more of an attritional contest than they needed to. Some of the tackles are messy. There was a tackle just, I think it was at the end of the first half, where he was kind of bursting towards the box and just got scythed down by two players simultaneously. It feels like, having watched these two Mexico games, I've learned nothing at all more than... Well, I've learned nothing additional about them.
Well, that's interesting,
isn't
it? Which
is kind of frustrating.
Well, we talked about the US yesterday, and there's been a lot of discourse already about the 2026 World Cup and that taking place in North America. Mexico, of course, is one of the three hosts, including Canada too. We haven't really talked about that. We've referenced it as it relates to the US men's national team, but for Mexico, 4 years ahead of that happening, I mean, this, you know, we assume, it's not certain yet, but there's good possibility that they will go out of the group stages. It'll be a great disappointment for them ahead of being hosts.
Yeah, it really will. I was having a conversation with a Mexican journalist who, about 3 weeks ago, who was talking about the failure to select Javier Hernandez, Chicharito, also the problems with Raul Jimenez. And also what it would be like when the World Cup is played in Mexico, or shared in the World Cup is shared with the United States and Canada. And it's a very big deal for a country like Mexico. Mm. And you just hope that, I think World Cup is all about timing. It's an economic situation. It is about what's right. It's a political movement as well, because it's a vote driver, obviously. Yeah,
sure.
But you always hope that, the country's footballing fortunes align with that, so that you're gifted with a good team at the right moment whereby you make the most of it. I think back to 2006 in Germany. So prior to that, people in Germany had a little bit of an issue with their flag and displaying it. They were uneasy around patriotism, and their football had fallen off a little bit of a cliff. They'd had a very, very poor European championship, two really poor European championships, separated by an unlikely run to a World Cup final. And in 2006, they had this young team with a vibrant, energetic Jurgen Klinsmann, and it captured the mood at the right time. They didn't win the tournament, but they produced a performance within the competition which sparked something and rejuvenated German football and capitalized on some of the technical work that had been going on in the background. And it was, you hope for the same thing in Mexico. You hope that there will be that nine, there will be that array of young attacking talent. You hope that someone, for instance, like, I hope I pronounce his name right, but Diego Lane, the winger who was touted to be an absolute star of the game a couple of years ago. He was at Betis. His career hasn't kind of followed the trajectory that was hoped for. You'd hope that would be the right tournament for that kind of player, because it's very, very important for the Mexican football public.
It's also worth remembering as well that Liga MX is the most popular domestic league in the States as well, isn't it? So in terms of, like, you know,
popular,
the sort of, not to take anything away from the United States or Canada, but it's just in terms of the domestic viewing situation, Liga MX kind of like the cultural home of it at the moment.
Yes, indeed.
So that'll be a really, really interesting take, I suppose, in 4 years' time. Okay, let's have a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to discuss Australia-Tunisia.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Lovely break. Wasn't that enjoyable? Did you enjoy that, Michael Bailey?
That was possibly the best break I've ever had.
You know what? I think I agree with you. Australia 1-0 Tunisia, John. Now, John. Last week, whenever it was, Australia didn't look good and Tunisia did look good. And then today, Tunisia didn't look good and Australia did look good.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Australia looked incredible, but they did enough to win a game, which is going to be great for them in getting out of this group if they are to do so.
Yes.
And it's, yeah, I think a bit of an interesting phenomenon which has happened in this World Cup, which is that there used to be one way that teams who were underdogs would play usually. And that was you'd sit, if you look at the board here, in a 4-4-2 deep block, compact space, don't let anyone towards the center of your goal.
Yes.
And you're just seeding space in these wide areas here and here.
The coward's maneuver.
The coward's maneuver, yeah, for sure. We saw Iran play like that against England.
Sure.
And what happens is that you make it hard for them to necessarily get good chances through the game. England were able to get a couple of low value chances early on and then were kicked on from there. The problem is that what you're not doing is, while you are seeding space in the wide areas, you're also seeding space in the rest of the pitch. So what you're doing is you're allowing the opposition to get forward quite comfortably.
Yeah.
And you're giving them plenty of chances to then just swing the ball into the box to try and
almost
chances.
Inevitably at some point they score.
Especially when they have such a big talent mismatch, right? So if you look at the England team now, you've got obviously Harry Kane as a goal scorer. I mean, and on his own, he'd be fine against a lot of these teams, just in terms of offering that threat. But then you have lots of other really creative players as well who can break down teams as well. And what you're doing then is just simply allowing a volume of chances to arrive in your box, and then you're just sort of playing lottery with how they go.
So in all likelihood, at some point, you know, they're going to get a better option, and they're maybe going to score a goal.
Yeah, you're simply saying go again, go again, go again. So when the ball goes in, it may be cleared out by one of the centre backs heading out, and it will usually drop into this sort of space where there'll be a free player who'll pick it up, recycle it, get it into the wide area, and you go again. But what we're seeing a little bit more in this World Cup actually is underdog teams who are a little bit happier to be risky and push forward.
The bold underdog.
The bold
as
underdog.
As opposed to the bald underdog.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Me and Seb are the bald underdogs.
Absolutely. That's just one of you.
But what we're seeing now, so on the board here, we're seeing teams out of possession just being quite aggressive in the way that they press. So Tunisia were playing with a back three. And what we were seeing from Australia was they were going pretty much player for player in this sort of situation. So Craig Goodwin was pushing forward onto one of the back three. And then you make sure that the wing back on that side is covered by your other wide player. And then this player will push up as well. What you're doing then is you're stopping the opposition from progressing the ball easily. And okay, that's a fairly scary situation to be in because you are leaving advanced players here on the back line, player for player. But the gamble that's being taken here is that if we can get I'm having a nightmare with these lines, but if the ball is being played over, then you've got big centre backs here or big full backs who are going to be able to clear the ball away. So you're not necessarily going to leave yourself exposed behind. And also, if you can stop the opposition from progressing the ball, then you don't have that situation we talked about before, which is the attacking team then has a lot of high volume chances to generate. Maybe they'll be low quality, but there'll be a high volume of them. What you're doing
now
is
they're just further away from the goal.
Yeah, you're keeping them further away from the goal.
That sounds stupid, doesn't it, when you say it like that? But like, the closer you are to the goal, the more likely you are to score. So if you're far away from the goal, you're less likely to score.
You'd have to kick it further and harder.
And harder.
Maybe with your head.
Yeah. You'd have to kick it with your head, exactly.
Yes.
It's almost impossible to do, John.
Yeah, and this is what we saw in England's two games, right? So you might wonder why England might go from battering one team 6-2 and then struggling against another team.
I was wondering that.
Yeah. And that's the difference. The difference was the US were happier to actually be a little bit more aggressive in their pressing, push higher up the field, and not allow England to progress the ball into the final third as much. And I think this is something that we're realizing in international football now, is that I think previously people were just worried, well, if you play with an aggressive high line and you go aggressive with your press, then people will just play over it all, teams will just play over it all the time. But we saw Argentina lose to Saudi Arabia playing in just that way. And so I think what we'll see as the tournament progresses, especially through the group stages where there will be more underdog football, we will see the teams who are aggressive in their pressing actually getting some joy from it.
Well, I'm loving it, and I expect people in Australia also are, Seb. Let's put this into context a little bit. What will the win mean?
Well, I was reading the Sydney Morning Herald afterwards, and there's the wonderful article there by their chief sports writer talking about just a really important moment in Australian football's present future. There are some amazing videos of the reactions in the street and in Australia, but also I think it's the third win in World Cup history for Australia. And that's an amazing thing, really, because like football, soccer will always struggle for attention against AFL and rugby league, against things like horse racing too and motorsport in Australia. But it's really an exciting time because this win comes shortly after. So there's an interesting situation developing in Australian domestic football. One of the problems there has always been giving significant game time to young Australian hopefuls, making sure they're on the pitch and making sure that the A-League isn't dominated by players who either aren't developing or players who are from different countries or have come over. And one of the other things is that, unfortunately, since the pandemic, there has been no youth league. Obviously, ordinarily, I think it's called the Y League. Apologies if I got that wrong. But that hasn't taken place since the pandemic. It hasn't restarted. And so the only place for young players who aren't quite ready to play A-League football to play has been in, I think it's the National Premier League, which is very sort of disjointed, all over the place affair, which plays during the winter months. It doesn't go on for very long. It's not really a proper breeding ground. However, it's kind of gone under the radar. I did a lot of reading up about this today, but there's been a big cash injection into Australian football. There's a company called Silverlake who they're like they're an investment fund, and they have holdings in the New Zealand All Blacks and in Klarna and Airbnb. And part of their objective is not just to kind of improve the experience of going to games as a fan, but also to help fund the restructuring of the leagues that support the A-League. And I think they spent something like $140 million, Australian dollars, to buy 33% of the company that controls that part of Australian football. Mm. And it's really good news because this is where you grow talent from. I looked it up and only eight of the players who made Australia's 26-man squad actually play in their football in Australia. And that's not unusual. I think you see that with a lot of South American countries, but having a strong domestic league is generally, it's helpful, of course. Yeah. And this is a good step towards it. So marry those two things up. You have a big win, a big win also for a coach who is continually under pressure. Arnold has been, when they lost to Japan, ahead of that sort of Peru playoff that got them to the World Cup, a lot of people wanted him sacked. There's been an awful lot of negativity in light of the defeat to France. I think Harry Kewell said some very negative things about him on Australian television. I think I haven't heard them, but that's just secondhand reporting.
Sure.
And so you get this big win, big moment of national pride, great winning goal, by the way. I think we'll come to that. And then in the background, you have a kind of reformatting and restructuring of the domestic footballing picture. And if you can combine those two things, then you should at least be heading somewhere quite good in the future.
Yeah.
I've monologued a little bit here, but only because during the course of the season, we've remarked on Christian Valpato's progress at Roma. He's had a few good performances just for the World Cup. He's scored a really great goal for Mourinho's Roma. He was actually born in New South Wales, I think, played for a range of clubs in the Sydney area. I think he played for West Sydney Wanderers for a little bit. And yet, and it was even I'm not sure, selected or invited, but he could have been part of this 26-man squad. He was a certain extended the invitation, rejected it. He wants to represent Italy. So what you have to do is make sure a player like that feels like there is a pathway, not just to, you know, further his career in a domestic club and to become the player he wants to be in Australia, but also then feels like it's a viable option to go in there and represent Australia. And he was born in Australia. So these are good things. They are things which don't always work in a linear, precise way, but there are positive aspects to where Australian football is headed. Certainly, if it becomes Argentinian football, that'd be very positive, wouldn't it?
I mean, that really that'd be
a great result. That'd be a great bit of investing, wouldn't it?
Although, on the basis of today, yeah. Maybe not.
But they were great. I loved what I saw. Maybe Michael can talk.
Well, am I the only one who didn't think they were that bad against France? I thought France were exceptional in the first game, just looked every inch a team ready to win the tournament. And Australia took the lead and scored a wonderful goal. And yeah, they wilted a bit after that. But I thought there were some really promising signs. It's just that, I know you said that, John, and also I had a friend who said, oh, Australia, worst team I've seen in the tournament. And I was like, oh, I don't think they were, but maybe it's just me.
I think
I'm glad you've said that, though, because sometimes I don't remember that game. But sometimes I think things and then other people say the other thing and I go, oh, I must be wrong. I mustn't say that I thought that in case I look stupid.
I think...
Which you wouldn't think would be something that would concern me, given how often I do appear stupid.
I wonder whether a lot of the controversy wasn't because, well, not controversy, criticism wasn't because the thing with Arnold, according to sort of Australian football fans or some of the critical Australian football fans.
Graham Arnold, by the way, yeah, first Australian-born coach to win a World Cup game.
It's an interesting story. He's ex-player. He played, obviously, his football, a lot of his football in Australia, but also he went to Japan. I think he played in Holland for a little bit, in the Netherlands. He's actually, I read today that he's a member of the Australian Football Hall of Fame. But he's not that popular. And I think one of the criticisms that he suffers more frequently is that he can't play proactive football. So football is always defensive. It's always back foot. It's always a little bit passive and people get frustrated. I don't know if that was the nature of criticism that Harry Kewell and other people were going for, but it seems quite likely. But it just felt like, well, you lost to France and you got overpowered and it just conformed to a lot of the negativity that existed beforehand. And I think it's quite fair because it's France, right? Like, what are you going to do? Like, I mean, it's just France. £1 billion worth of player on the pitch. It's just that Australia took the lead and, you know, had some good moments. I don't mean to be patronizing, but that's quite good. This was clearly the more winnable game and they got it done. They played in a certain way, but then they played to their strengths. And a good moment for him, clearly.
Yeah,
he's going to leave his position at the end of the World Cup, by the way. So his contract is up and he's going to take a bit of a hiatus. So this is a kind of Terry Venables at Euro 96 situation.
Isn't Ange Postecoglou from Australia?
Yes.
You like him, don't you?
Yes.
Maybe he could be the Australia manager next.
He already has been.
Oh, maybe he could have been the Australia manager in the past and I didn't know about it.
Yes.
Yes, okay, fine. Good to know. Well, what about Tunisia?
I have very few thoughts about Tunisia.
Okay.
Can I ask John a tactical question?
Sure. Is it about Harry Souttar?
It could be, but it's more about Aaron Moy.
Absolutely. Hey, Moy so bien.
It's also just an excuse to use the board. So what I'm going to do is on the board, I'm just putting the Australian defenders back into their low block. So I want to highlight something that I thought worked particularly well. Jackson Irvine played very, very well, by the way. He's also an excellent person.
Yeah. Look at Seb fill time while he's moving players around. Isn't that nice?
What I like is that, and what I always think is one of the most admirable roles in this is that obviously the attention goes to the players that are in the deep block. So Harry Souttar played absolutely fantastically. He reminded me of Paul McGrath at USA 94 in the sense that I think he's only played 90 minutes for Stoke, 90 minutes of league football this season. So to come to a World Cup and to play as well as he has done is amazing. But what I like is when the ball is played into the box and it's cleared away, it will fall to, in this instance, someone like Aaron Moy. And the temptation, if you're in that situation, must always be to just go, oh God, get rid of it.
Yeah.
But in reality, like, the football's quite difficult to position, isn't it?
That's quite a tricky move.
It is a tricky. You have to be very precise with it.
That's why
people don't realise how hard.
Ironic. That's why football's hard, isn't it? Yeah, it's hard to use the ball.
The ball is very small. Yes, the ball is difficult to use. Yeah. Anyway, the ball.
And you're trying to play it with a pen.
Absolutely.
That's what you're going wrong.
And it's very tricky. You might accidentally burst it if you
exactly.
You know, pen is pointy.
Yeah.
So the ball will drop to someone like Moy, and for people who are listening rather than watching, he's kind of about 15 yards out of his box. What I like is the way that a player like that has the composure to step on the ball, essentially win time for himself, and then play a pass to somebody else and allow a move to build around him. That's just really interesting. It's a very specific skill set, it feels to me, John.
Yeah.
And it's something that, like, I don't know. It's something that I feel that when a team sets up that way, people don't really talk about that much.
Yeah, I mean, Aaron Moy's played at quite a high level, I think, compared to some of the players in this team as well. And that's the reason why, right? The ability to have composure on the ball and to buy time for your teammates is going to get you to that level. So he was in the Man City system. I mean, he didn't ever play for them, I don't think, but he had Premier League experience with Huddersfield as well, is now playing for Celtic in Scotland. And that's what you want from him. You want someone who's going to be able to have the time to get the ball under control and then play the passes that he can play. But yeah, we should talk about Big Harry Suter, shouldn't we?
Yeah, go on.
I think so.
Can I just pass on some love to Seb from the comments section? Reese Love said, Seb Stafford bored. Well done. There you go.
Thank you so much, Reese.
OAR. Yeah. Yeah. Mm. I mean,
what did we think of
it's good to clarify that.
I thought that was quite an important point.
No, absolutely. For people who are listening, yes, bored, as in, yes.
The tactics board.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
What did we make of Seb's
fantastic. Fantastic. Yeah, very
I'm
impressive.
Feeling under threat.
He described what he was doing perfectly well. I expect the experience of the audio listener will have been greatly improved by his constant narration and over-cautiousness to discuss everything he was doing.
And everybody have a nice time.
In words.
Yeah.
Look at that. Your go.
Yeah, big Harry Suter playing for Stoke, but he's not really had a particularly great career so far because it's been blighted by injury. He obviously started out in Scotland and has played for a number of different teams there. Even since going to Stoke, he's rehabbed a little bit in Scotland as well, I think, but had an excellent game today. All 6'6" of him. Mm. He's a big lad.
That is big.
He is coming back from, I think, an ACL injury because he's obviously quite tall. So there's a lot of leverage on
there's
that.
There's a lot of stuff to support.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Let's just pause here for one moment. Who's the biggest, tallest player to ever play for Norwich?
Oh, my goodness. probably Peter Crouch, I would guess.
Oh, Peter Crouch was at Norwich?
Yeah, only on loan, but they all count.
Yeah, okay. But for wide, Grant Holt?
Why not?
Yeah.
So you don't really measure players by width, do they?
I don't know. That's how we measure height in my home. we pull the tape measure this way, and then we look at the floor and walk away sadly.
Yeah. Would you go with waist measurements? You think that we should add
6'4".
We should add that
this
to FB ref. Yeah.
But could you keep talking about Big Harry Suter?
Yeah.
Big, tall, vertical.
Yeah, and obviously being big, tall, and vertical is good for centre-backs. Mm-hmm. And he had a great game defensively, but he's also really good on the ball. Really good passer of the ball as well. And I would not be surprised if someone comes in for him this January. Certainly expecting to move up the leagues in the summer. So it'll be interesting to see how he gets on, where he goes. And this is what the World Cup's all about, right? It's players who've gone under the radar, have a good tournament, and someone will buy them.
And then clubs overpay for them.
Yeah, exactly. And then they don't work out. But
can't wait for that to happen.
I think it's about time that Suter got...
Not for Harry Suter.
Suter got a league that's slightly...
Oh, I'm so sorry I talked over that. I didn't realise that something
was a bad
good
joke
was coming.
It happened upon me in the moment, and it's probably better that you talked over it.
Well, okay. In which case, shall we go to a break and let everyone think about John's joke?
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
I'm still thinking about it.
Me too, after that break.
I'm chalking on the inside.
I liked it. I'd have written that down.
You're a real counterculture guy, aren't you?
Oh, yeah.
You're always
constantly
just saying the opposite. Anyway, listen, Denmark won to France, Michael Bailey. Mbappe, he scored both goals today. He's good, isn't he?
It struck me in the Australia game that I was watching as someone who was the very elite level at a very in good form, who could really grab a game at a major tournament, and you could come through in sort of 3 or 4 weeks time and just go, wow, that is, you've done something special there. Everyone knows what he's good at. He's good at very lots of many things. Mm-hmm. And it's just a joy to watch him carry that out, regardless of who he's playing against.
It's quite interesting, isn't it? Because obviously Norway and Erling Haaland aren't at the tournament. And I think at least in the UK and I suppose anywhere that would be Premier League focused, Haaland has been enormous since the beginning of the season. And there's been an awful lot of conversation about him. Mbappe, in terms of domestic football, seems to have kind of faded away a little bit in the general consciousness, or at least the general Premier League fan consciousness. But this is a real opportunity for him to dispel those ideas, isn't it?
Well, I think that's why the World Cup is such a special occasion for everyone, regardless of where you're watching football and where your concentration is generally. Lots of people watch the Champions League, but it's not in the same level as to watching a domestic football, and things become a name and sort of a few clips on social media, but to actually watch them do what they're doing live and impact a situation that you're also invested in because of who else you're watching or following at the same time, I think it just captures imagination. And I mean, he's done it before at major tournaments, hasn't he? I think he's really shone up and had a really positive impact. It's not anything that people don't know, but it's just like a reminder. I just sat through that first opening game. I thought, yeah. And again tonight, really, to be honest, I think that's what I'm watching for.
That's the feeling I want, is to be reminded how good somebody is. John, what do you think about his performances so far?
Yeah, I think as Michael says, it's not particularly profound to say that Mbappe is good, right? We all know that, but it is nice to see him performing in the international game as well. I think the international game suits him. I think he is one of the best off-ball movers in terms of his ability to attack space. Obviously, he has just incredible acceleration and the ability to just do things at a pace that professional defenders cannot deal with, which is so much of what it comes down to at this level, right? I don't think people, because you're used to seeing professional footballers play against professional footballers all the time, you get a misapprehension about what is and isn't realistic for humans to do. But then Mbappe comes along and he does things that make him look like he's on another level still, which makes it, I think that's why he stands out, right? Because you are suddenly made aware of the fact that this guy is on a different level physically and athletically to a lot of the other people on the highest levels of the sport. So yeah, I thought it was a really, really good performance from him. Not surprising. And I think it took him, his goals took him level with Messi, and in terms of World Cup goals. Obviously, yeah. Messi then went ahead of him in the next game. But I think Messi and Ronaldo both have the same number of World Cup goals now, which is 8, I believe.
Right.
And Mbappe's on 7 at the age of 23. Obviously, Messi and Ronaldo are towards the end of their careers, and he is very much at the start. And we've been talking a lot about Olivier Giroud, who is a joint record scorer for France, along with Thierry Henry. And I think we calculated on the basis of the graph, at the rate at which he's growing, that he will probably overtake their record at around
16 years old.
Yeah, he's going to get younger. It's a remarkable fact about him, but he is going to hit that level around 27, which is, I think, he'll be at the next World Cup. So by the time the next World Cup swings around, wouldn't be surprising to see him actually be the record French goal scorer.
Goodness gracious me. Well, listen, I have just spotted the one and only JJ Bull in the chat.
Ooh, and what's he saying?
I'm going to listen. I'm sure that both of you might be a little bit unhappy about this, given the competitiveness around points are bad. And JJ has technically already had his one reminder, although when I reminded him a couple of days ago, he said he was typing out his predictions as I was typing. Okay. So I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt and say that on his day off, given that he's watching the stream from home and hasn't remembered to send me those predictions, we really don't want him to incur 20 penalty points for tomorrow. That would be a shame. Well, not for you, John, because you'd be first. But JJ, you've got about 10 minutes to get those predictions over to me. So I'd really hurry up.
And, Rooney!
There's a Rooney. Now we're all imagining scrabbling around his home looking for his phone. All the best. He's been here all night, he says. Oh, no. Yeah, exactly. There we go. Fine. Okay, well, that was Mbappe. France, though, Seb, almost kind of quietly winning their first two games, 6 points. You know, they were very, very good on day one, but it was Australia, and so there was a conversation in the same way that there was with England, Iran, around, well, how much can you really tell about how good they are? Denmark, not an easy team to beat, but they kind of made it look a bit easy.
I don't know. I thought Denmark played pretty well.
I didn't watch the game. I just took a punt that might have been
happened,
but it wasn't.
I think when we talked about this last night, we expected this would be close. I think I predicted 1-1 in points are bad. So I thought Denmark might get something. Ultimately, not quite. We've talked about Mbappe being the difference. I was super impressed with Antoine Griezmann, just in the sense that he was... I know what his abilities are, but I think he's giving us a very kind of selfless... range of performances at the moment in terms of where he's picking up the ball, what he's doing with it, how he's using it. I think Griezmann's been fantastic. I do. And there's nothing here that suggests that France aren't what they were in 2018. For instance, like, I think you can find this performance in that World Cup. I think you can find it in other tournaments in which they've gone far and beaten a lot of teams and, you know, got to finals and semifinals. So that they managed to dig out the win is just another French victory for a very gifted set of players. And I think also we talked a little bit last night about, and the night before actually, about tournament performances, managing tournaments and getting through. This felt a little bit like that. It's like they'd ever hit top gear. They had little surges of power, which Mbappe provided, and moments where Giroud did something which created a little bit of an opportunity. They had one falling volley, which is very, very close to being one of the goals of the tournament.
Yes.
But this was, I don't know, I never worried about France during this. And it always felt, actually, between the Danish equaliser and the French winner, I went out to collect my food that had been delivered to the front of the office.
Ah.
And I came back and I kind of knew in my heart hearts when I did, France would be ahead. And I walked back into the office and there was Kylian Mbappe celebrating in the corner. It felt kind of inevitable. And that is reflective of nothing other than I trust this French team.
Yeah.
And there's nothing that I've seen so far which has kind of impacted upon that, really.
That's right. Interesting element of Seb's poshness there. Had his food delivered to him by another human.
Carried. Me, yeah.
Whereas John and I outside in the field picking up grain and trying to make bread out of it unsuccessfully, hey?
Yeah.
That's right.
Couple of hungry boys. Now, listen, let's talk about Denmark before we move on. Denmark, I want to talk about their set piece goal, one of very few. John's going to talk about that. But Denmark protests beforehand. Phil Buckingham wrote an interesting thing about this on The Athletic, Seb. What do you think?
Developing story. So the Danish FA have suggesting that the Danish FA is threatening to withdraw from FIFA in response to, everything that we've seen so far within this tournament. Yeah. Also, there's a suggestion that other FAs are also... of the same mind. This is something to keep an eye on.
Is it on the precipice?
I don't know. On the precipice might be a little bit too strong. I don't know. Sure. We've heard... I'm really reticent about this sort of thing because we've heard so much rhetoric and we've heard so many threats and we've heard so many promises to take action.
Yeah.
Not least with, obviously, Armband Gate over the past few days, that I never trust anything of this type until you actually see it take place.
Sure.
Danish have been very vocal. The Danish people back in Denmark, this tournament is very, very unpopular with them. There have been protests. There have been suggestions that even from the point of qualifying, the Danish people and Danish supporters have been very against the team's participation in Qatar. So I don't know, but this is something that's going to carry on. I think the Danish, with the adjustments they made to their strip, the Hummel strip, which has been adjusted to make sure that you can't see the logos as well as you might. And that includes obviously the Danish crest, the crest of the Danish Football Association. They have been more proactive than most. And they've thought about their protest more than most too. It's not sort of some of the things you've seen in this tournament have been, don't want to do anyone a disservice, but some of them have been a little bit on the hoof in the sense that they've been reflexive and what should we do? It feels like people have met and discussed things the night before, for instance. Danish FA have a kind of a stronger position. So keep following the coverage. As you mentioned, Phil Buckingham is writing about it, and I expect he'll be writing more about it before the end of the World Cup.
Do you know who's hot for that is Uncle Damien? Uncle Damien's been talking about breaking up FIFA for years. In the pub, of course, from behind the bar where he's serving drinks. Anyone that asks, he'll say, we should break it apart. The nation, you know, the nations should leave, or, you know, start a new one or something. You know, I guess it's been a popular topic of conversation for a long time. It's interesting though, isn't it? Like on the eve of this tournament, the Netflix documentary comes out. We talked a lot in the first episode about Gianni Infantino's bizarre speech. They seem to just weather every storm, but we haven't got time to discuss this. We'll do this on another occasion. We've only got a few minutes and there's so much more to discuss, particularly the much more important topic of set piece goals, because of course that's more important than what I stopped us talking about to discuss.
Can I do something that I'm not supposed to do?
Sure. As long as it doesn't get us in trouble.
It won't get us in
trouble.
We
are live.
It's just a little tweak of the ordering, because I wanted to talk a little bit about France.
Oh, go ahead.
Done that. But one of the things that happened in the first game was that Lucas Hernandez got injured. Actually, when Australia scored their goal, went off and was replaced by his brother, Teo, who is playing.
That'll explain why I didn't notice.
Yeah. Teo is playing for Milan at the moment, and one of the most aggressive running fullbacks in the world at the moment, really, really dangerous for them, and has linked up really well with Kylian Mbappe. Obviously, it's not great that his brother got injured, but it could be one of the things I think that makes France more dangerous this tournament. And we talked about them in previous tournaments as being maybe quite a solid, structured team who don't really get too adventurous in terms of possession. But I think with Teo Hernandez, they're able to get forward into these sorts of, well, he's able to get forward into more advanced areas and link up with Mbappe, pull defenses apart. So especially when you're playing against a team like Denmark, who are going to play with a back five when the opposition are in their final, in their third. When you've got someone like Teo Hernandez, making really aggressive runs into these sorts of areas.
The areas between the wing back and the outside centre back.
That's right, yeah. The seam runs, as we call them.
Yeah.
And actually, this is the way that the goal was scored tonight. The second goal tonight was scored by Hernandez getting to the byline and playing the ball back to Mbappe, who then scored. And I think it'll be a really fruitful avenue for them. So just an interesting thing that, you know, had it not been for the case that his brother got injured, then maybe France wouldn't have won the game today.
Very interesting. Yeah. Okay, well, Denmark did get one goal. It was from a set piece. I believe it's one of only four in the tournament so far, which is a bit unusual for international football to see so few. Normally you would see more.
Yeah, I think someone had done a graph showing you the amount of goals that are scored per set piece in international tournaments compared to open play goals, and it was something like 70% of goals or something are scored by set pieces. But obviously in this tournament we've had over 50 goals now. I haven't got the exact number of goals that have been scored, but only four of them have come from set pieces, and by set pieces I'm meaning free kicks and corners rather than penalties. There have been some penalties as well, but very unusual, especially because a lot of teams work on their set pieces now, because it, in the international level, as we were saying, like if you're playing up against a team who are playing a low block, and we talked about having a higher volume of chances to create dangerous moments, one of the things that you'll get from that as well is that you will generate more corner kicks, right? Which means that you can practice your corner kick techniques as a team who are going to have a lot of possession, and you can get a lot of joy from that in a productive sense. And you'll remember the last World Cup, and in the Euros, I think England generated a lot of goals from set pieces. But it doesn't seem to be the case in this tournament. I suppose we're going to ask why, and I don't necessarily...
The bold underdog, the different approaches, maybe.
Yeah, maybe partly that, actually, that there aren't as many teams who are just happy to accept pressure just over and over and over again. But again, these things are always like cyclical, so there'll be a sense in which a lot of teams, I think, will have come into this tournament aware of the fact that set pieces are dangerous, And will probably work quite hard defending set pieces, because again, that's something that you can, that is quite repeatable. It's worth your while doing it. So I guess that a lot of teams will have decent systems in place for that as well. And also, I think, you know, set pieces are becoming more dangerous in the domestic game because there are people in the domestic game now who specialize in set pieces. So Spurs this season have got Gianni Vio as their a set piece specialist, and it's obviously having a good impact for them. Maybe that's just not translating as well into the international game because you don't have as much time to work on these things as well. I suspect that what's happening is that teams aren't spending a lot of time developing dangerous attacking set pieces, but they're spending a lot of time on the principles of defending set pieces, and it's maybe ironing out as well.
Or every goal from now on will be a set piece. And what do they say? Rue what you sow.
Mm. I always rue what I sow.
Yeah. Is it rue?
Reap.
Well, you generally reap what you sow.
But you could rue what you sow.
I suppose, say, if you sowed something really, really bad, you would probably rue the sowing.
You would rue the sowing.
Yeah, you would, yeah.
I reckon John McKenzie's always ruing sowing. Don't you think?
I think you've mixed a few metaphors here.
I'm not constantly mixing metaphors, John McKenzie.
Do you rue your sowing of metaphors?
Yes, I do. I wish I'd never said anything. Now, listen, we're really short on time, but Saudi Arabia 0-2 Poland. Michael, you watched this game, didn't you?
It was on. Yeah, I did. I did watch it. It was a wonderful penalty save from Wojciech Szczesny.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure I've said that right, haven't I?
I think you've done a very good job.
Where he kind of, you know, as players seem to look to watch what the goalkeeper does before taking their penalty. Mm. It was a classic case of a goalkeeper going, right, I'm going to try and dummy where I'm going and then go back the other way.
Yeah.
He did a brilliant job of saving it. He made several really, really good saves in the game too. And, you know, Saudi Arabia were fun again and pressed well. And I think they had a lot of really good territory. And Szczesny did have to make a few good saves, but it felt like it was in Poland's gift if they kind of produced a little bit of quality that they would go on and win the game. I think they were given a pretty significant helping hand to which Robert Lewandowski prayed, I think. Sure. And he was in tears. He was moved to tears. It was his first World Cup goal.
Well, indeed, he scored over 70 goals for Poland, Michael Bailey. But this is his first World Cup goal.
But again, we talked about the emotions on players. And the fact that Robert Lewandowski is in tears at scoring his first World Cup goal tells you that up until that point, he knew that he hadn't scored one and it was obviously weighing on him. You know, passes were going through to him and they were coming off the back of his heels or he was tripping over the ball, pretty much all sorts. And that's just, you've got such a wonderfully gifted striker, unable to coordinate himself.
It's really interesting, isn't it? You also would have thought if we're thinking in sort of stereotypes, right? Robin Lewandowski will see the World Cup draw. We'll see Saudi Arabia in the group. I'm going to score a goal in that game. And then you watch Saudi Arabia beat Argentina in game one and you go, oh no, that's not what I thought was going to happen.
Having missed a penalty in the opening game as well himself. And then, he is absolutely gifted. The goal in the end. So maybe credit to him for staying on his feet and slotting home.
It's funny, isn't it? Because like players treat the World Cup as like the pinnacle, I think, in a way that maybe football fans, and I use that phrase to mainly mean the people who watch domestic football regularly, probably wouldn't think of it in quite the same way.
I really agree. If you think about the amount of times in World Cup games you've seen players overcome, I always think of that John Brooks goal in 2014 for the USA, that late header, and you could see the gravity of the moment to him. The Ghanaian score against Portugal, who did the Ronaldo celebration. I know that people thought it was a kind of a mugging off of Ronaldo, but actually he came out and said on social media that I was just overcome by scoring for my country in a World Cup. It's hugely significant, and it feels massive in a way that a lot of club goals don't. Even club goals that are really significant, so like winning a Champions League semi final or scoring for your country at a World Cup it's very elusive for people like us to understand what that would be like. The scale of it is just so massive. It's a really lovely part of it, though. I've always enjoyed seeing that in a football match when you see momentous moments, and the World Cup's legend is kind of built on it, isn't it? Like you look back at kind of some of the images in the past, like Marco Tardelli's obviously the one that everybody remembers, but there's a lot of them if you dig deep enough.
Yeah, I think like with someone like Pele, you think of him in terms of like winning World Cups and stuff, but I don't think, well, obviously Ronaldo and Messi are unlikely to win World Cups in their careers, and they'll be the players that we remember from this generation. And we will remember them for their Champions League wins and their Ballon d'Or wins rather than for their World Cup wins. But it is just interesting for me that the players still have that sort of mythic respect for the World Cup.
Do you think it's a release of pressure? Because when we talk about Lewandowski, can you imagine how much of a topic of conversation his lack of goals in a World Cup is in Poland, for instance? In the same way that Lionel Messi's performances for Argentina dominate, I imagine the Argentinian sports press during international breaks, probably outside of them too, when you deliver for your country, you are probably, in most cases, hitting back at critics or, diffusing a negative conversation that's been going on around you. And that's got to be pretty massive as well. It's got to feel very, very, I don't even know what the word is, but it must feel very freeing, I guess. And that's probably why you see these moments of expression.
Yeah, and I felt like he played better after he got the goal.
100%.
Yeah. Can I bring in Josh Sargent at this point?
Please do.
Because I spoke to
You've
Josh.
You've been waiting the whole show, haven't
this
you?
Is the, I didn't think it would come up. I spoke to Josh Sargent.
You spoke to Josh Sargent?
I did, like in real life.
Wow.
Can I just say, he's a lovely guy.
I expect he is.
He is a really lovely guy. I spoke to him before he left Norwich to join up with the US. It was his final game. In which he scored, by the way. But there was a line in there about what it would mean to him to play at the World Cup. And he just emphasized the fact that it was the chance to just operate on a higher, bigger stage than would otherwise happen, bearing in mind he played in the Premier League last season. Yeah. And I think there's just that. Now, you know, my cynical Norwich journalist hat is like, oh, yeah, you're going to, you know, score a couple of goals and get a move. And I think there is that element of whatever they can do at the World Cup as well. For any player at any country, you've got an opportunity to show something special that will be seen by a wider, far wider audience than normal, but also potentially it opens doors, doesn't it, to what could happen next.
I think this is the key point, is that, you know, when you strip it all away and you realize that you are going to die, legacy is really all that matters to people. Even if they think they don't care about legacy, I think most people, they start to think about it. What will I be remembered for?
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily matter how much money you have, how much material success you have. If you will be remembered for something, that seems to be a kind of currency that you can take with you into the grave, you know? And I expect with footballers doing something at the World Cup, it's the biggest possible audience. And whether or not regular football fans are domestic football fans or, you know, footballers see the World Cup as the highest tier of the game, it's probably not in terms of the quality of the football, for example, but it certainly is in terms of its cultural position, and also just purely the size of the audience and the scale of people's feeling for it.
It's a great point, because actually you remember stuff from World Cups much easier.
Yeah.
Like seasons, domestic seasons run into one another.
Yeah.
That's just a way of it, the sheer volume of football. But like, I can recall a lot of stuff from all the World Cups I've been alive for. And so when you score a goal or do something really important, nobody can ever take that away from you, and you become an indelible part of the game's conscious.
And almost. It's every 4 years. Yeah. I mean, we had this conversation earlier this year or last year, whenever it was, the idea of it increasing the regularity of the World Cup. I think one of the reasons you remember it is because it's very, very special.
Yeah.
Because it happens only once ever so often. Now, listen.
What do you want to be remembered for? What do you want your legacy to be, Joe?
We don't have enough time for me to discuss my manifesto today, but I'll bring it with me for another live show, and I'll tell you.
The time you beat me at chess, is that your legacy to the world?
Do you know what? I'd already forgotten that. That's how little it means to me. Now, listen, let's move on and just to talk about this group in general, because I'll tell you at the moment, the current state of affairs, Poland on 4 points, Argentina on 3 points, Saudi Arabia on 3 points, Mexico on 1 point. This group, Michael Bailey, is wide open going into the third game. What are your expectations?
It's going to be fun. It's difficult, isn't it? Because Poland-Argentina should be a really interesting game.
Yeah.
But they could both probably not do with drawing it, I guess. So they're in a really difficult position. I expect people on the touchline will be feeding the latest score to all the players, to Messi, just Messi, and then he can deal with it from there and just take that on his shoulders. I don't know.
No, I don't know.
I've got no idea what's going to, but it's going to be fun. It's going to be so fun to watch.
It's going to be fun. Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll leave it with that. Now, listen, before we go and play Points Are Bad, a couple of things for you, Michael Bailey. The first is for me to present you with a book. Look at this book here.
This
book is called How to Watch Football. 52 rules for understanding the beautiful game on and off the pitch. Now, whilst you don't need this because you're a qualified journalist, I thought maybe you would want to gift it to someone. and then tell the podcast listeners and viewers about how good it is just right now, immediately?
Oh, it looks like it's taken so much wonderful work by incredibly talented people.
Yes.
I can just have a flick through here. And do watch the lines, for example. So all about the pitch markings, which I hadn't really ever thought about, but I know I now need to really double check and delve into. Can I go now just to read this?
No, because I have more questions to ask you.
Thank you so much. That's such a lovely present.
If you're watching that or listening to this and thinking, well, I'd love to get my hands on whatever Michael Bailey's going cuckoo for, then you should head into your local Waterstones if such a thing exists.
There's one in Norwich.
Near where you are. There's one in Norwich.
Yes.
Look at that. Get on down to the Waterstones in Norwich. That sounds like a good place to be. Or, of course, if you live in a place where there isn't a Waterstones, I don't know.
Wasserstein.
I don't know how far the... the Wasserstein, exactly.
the Wasserstein in Hamburg.
If you're in Germany, head to Wasserstein in Hamburg. And you might see Seb loitering around there, of course. How to Watch Football by TIFO Football. Please do check that out. And, of course, it's available online too. But head in to your local Wasserstein's. Now, I've got a couple of questions for you.
So I stop holding it up now?
That's you did a good job there, though.
You did very well.
Excellent
with
prop person.
Good posture with the book.
Two quick questions for you, Michael Bailey. The second one, a bit longer. First one, what's your favourite game so far?
Good question. Let's have a think. I enjoyed Wales-Iran because there was a lot of jeopardy in that game.
I love jeopardy.
And it was a lot of fun. And I think Portugal-Ghana probably as well was just kind of all over the place.
Sure,
yeah, one of those.
I was going to ask you another question, but it'll take a lot longer, and tonally it feels weird, so I'm just going to move past it and go straight to Points Are Bad. Should we play Points Are Bad, everyone?
Really,
yeah, except you, Michael Bailey, unfortunately, you can't play. But listen, JJ has sent me his notifications. He sent me a picture of himself as well. Yes. There you go. He sent me a nice picture of himself looking all sad. That's funny. But we've got his notifications now. Right, fine. So, Points Are Bad. Let me tell you how we all did on this day, which was day 7. Was it day 7? Good Lord. Look at that. They fly by, don't they? Day 7.
We're sitting here with our headphones on waiting for the song.
Oh, the song!
The song.
I'm not very good at my job. Let's put the headphones on. Key it, DJ Jamie. We go.
You'd be a good radio DJ, I reckon. When your voice just came in over the music there, it just sounded...
And Jamie would be a great radio technician because he knew when to dip, huh? Mm. He's heard it all before.
Faded that out really nicely, didn't he?
He did a good job. Well done, Jamie. Hey, big thumbs up from Jamie.
Great job, Jamie.
Now listen, let's play Points Are Bad. Points Are Bad, they are very, very bad. But today they're not that bad for Seb Stafford-Bloor, who is... in second place. I'm so sorry. Oh. I built that up a little bit. And it wasn't on purpose. It's because I didn't see that JJ had a lower score than you for today.
If Seb had a good day on Points Are Bad, he'd beat Seb Stafford 4 points.
Yeah. But actually, you're Seb Stafford 5 today. Oh. And it's JJ Bull on the 4. John, you've had a shocker insofar as you're joining me in last place on 7, which was not so bad. You know, 7's not bad. It's a pretty good day all around. The point's getting really tight there now, Michael. Really tight. Now, we'll discuss... let me just quickly tell you, I got a perfect score prediction. Argentina-Mexico are predicted correctly. Yeah, and only one other correct prediction. Oh, two. Seb, you predicted Tunisia-Australia exactly right, and JJ predicted France-Denmark exactly right. John, no such luck for you today. But, of course, that means John and I, in last place, get to go. First, John, I will give you the honours, because almost every other day I'm going first. Let us discuss.
These are quite tricky. It's quite a tricky day for predictions, I think.
I think I agree with you, so it's a good day to go first for you. Japan-Costa Rica is where we begin.
Oh. I almost don't want to go first, but...
Indeed.
I feel like I've gone too high on most of my predictions.
I think that's why you've gathered so many points, yes.
Yes, but I feel as though Japan are going to be much better than Costa Rica. So
right.
I'm going to go 3-0, because I think that's a good, like a sweet spot between 2-0 and 4-0. I'm only 1 point if I get it wrong.
Okay, fine. Japan, I think Costa Rica are going to surprise. Yeah? by scoring a goal. I'm going to say this is going to be a 2-1 over Japan and Costa Rica. Seb, you are next.
I'm going to say 3-0 Japan.
John quite literally just said that about 1 meter in front of you. So
I was not listening. I was busy looking at tomorrow's fixtures. I will say 2-0 Japan.
2-0 Japan. Okay. Now, JJ, of course, is the winner today, is in last place. So for Japan, he says 2-0, can't have. 1-0, he can have.
He just goes for low scores.
Yeah, that's how he wins the game. That's why
he
won the...
He doesn't win life, though, does he?
His winning points are bad. I told you this at the beginning of the tournament. JJ will just predict low scores in order to, if he messes up, what's the likelihood of it being 5-0? Very low.
But as if it it will be glorious.
That's why I always go for 5-0.
I live in hope.
Well, listen, John, you're about to live in hope in a very real way with Belgium and Morocco.
This is a horrible one to predict.
Very tough.
Belgium were awful in the first game. They're a bit stodgy. Morocco were quite good. Mm. So I'm going to go 2-1 to Belgium.
2-1 to Belgium. Okay. I don't know what to say here. I mean, I suppose I'm going to say 1-1.
Oh.
Yeah. I think Belgium were poor. I think Belgium were poor. Seb, what do you think?
2-0 Morocco.
2-0 Morocco.
Yeah, I think Morocco do them. Yeah.
That is a big shot. And I tell you what, if he's correct
there. He's only got 1-0. He's gone 2-0.
Seb can really... He literally has. Yeah. He hasn't gone 3-0. No. He's gone 2-0.
Or 4-0.
Or 4-0.
2-0.
Or 6-0.
Makes you think, doesn't it?
He's gone 2-0. And JJ Bull, the Bullard, he requested 1-1, which is taken. He requested 1-2. He's only written Belgium, so I'm assuming 1-2 means 2-1 to Morocco.
Yeah.
So we'll give him. Okay.
Well, that could go well for me if it goes to the... Actually, it doesn't make a difference. It's only two.
It's so prescient, though, isn't he? It's like he's heard Seb's good call, and he's gone to block it with a 1 in there. Fine. The next game we're discussing is Croatia-Canada. JJ in the chat saying he does live a win at life. I'm not so sure. I don't know. I don't want to go into details, I feel like it would be inappropriate to do that on a live stream.
I hear a chuckling from producer Jamie in the background.
Oh, be careful, Jamie. He's in tomorrow. Okay, John, let's begin with you. Croatia, Canada. Also
this
quite
is
a
another
tough
hard one, isn't it?
Yeah, they're all hard. It's not... Oh, my God, there's a really exciting game next. I didn't notice. We'll get to that, though.
Okay. I'm going to go...
Croatia, Canada.
2-1 to Croatia.
Okay, I'm all about Canada here. I'm all about Canada. I'm going for a 1-2 Canada to win. Seb Stafford-Bloor.
2-0. 2-0 Croatia.
2-0 Croatia. Yeah. Okay. It's interesting that Seb, all three of Seb's predictions so far have been 2-0. I wonder, have you is your brain still working?
That I'm in.
Yeah.
He's just glitching, isn't he?
He's glitching. Okay, and JJ thinks 1-0 to Canada. Okay. So there we go.
There's another one where I could pull back a few points.
It's a straight split on the last two. That's how tight these games are. That's how difficult they are to predict. Seb and JJ going one way, John and I going another. So if today's anything to go by, John.
I'm a bit worried. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah. Points are bad.
But we're not gambling on results. We're gambling on goals scored. That's
exactly
the way I look at it.
That is,
you look at it that way too, don't you?
That's how the game
you're
works.
A smart man.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why I'm losing. John, Spain, Germany.
Oh, this is...
What a big game, though. Surely Germany are going to surprise, aren't they? That's how that isn't that how it works?
And they've got
life?
A win as well.
Yeah.
And JJ's going to say Spain win. So if I want to catch him up...
You're right inside your own head now. It's only day 7.
I'm locked in. I'm going to go Spain 2-0.
Spain 2-0. You're predicting Germany out? Okay, fine. I'm going to say it's going to be Germany 2-1. Seb Stafford-Bloor.
Germany 1-0.
You think Germany 1-0? Yeah. Wow, you predict Spain not to score at all. Okay.
Yeah, I like Germany tomorrow.
That is interesting. And JJ has asked for, he says, 1-1, which is available. So JJ gets his first pick there. Well, very exciting. How about that, hey? Now, let us look at the grand totals for day, as of day 7. There's developing a bit of a gap now. The gap between first and last was only 10 yesterday. It's 13 now. And that's because I'm on 60 points in last place. Points are bad, remember, Michael
points
Bailey?
Okay.
Points are bad.
You don't want points.
I thought you were doing really so well.
The
thank
first
you,
rule
yeah.
of points are bad is points are bad.
Yeah.
Bad.
Very, very bad. Seb Stafford-Bloor, you've made some ground, but sadly not enough. You have gained a couple of points on second place to John.
Okay.
You're on 56.
That's good.
John's on 52. But of course, John, yesterday there was only 2 points between you and JJ. And now there's five, which is one of the, that's the biggest growth gap of all. JJ pulling ahead there, having a very, very good day with just the 4 points. Now, if we look at the last couple of days, he's doing well, isn't he? Yeah. We all have to, at some point, do an alliance against him.
How?
We could really hurt him.
We just need to not talk about it. So I mean, he gets to be 20 fair, points, right?
I could have not reminded him this was happening and he would have gained 20 points. But that's not who we are, guys.
Yes, it is.
We're more creative in how we sabotage. Now, that's the end of today's episode. Let me say a resounding thank you to Mr. Michael Bay. I think a round of applause, Michael.
Yes. Oh, look at that.
Yeah, just seven eyes.
I clap myself.
Bit of a slow.
Like a footballer. Great work, team.
Yeah. It was a bit of a slow uptake on the clap, wasn't it?
I got one.
Hard to know if people meant that. Seb Stafford-Blore, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Joe Devine.
We'll see you again tomorrow. Oh, we're clapping everyone. Yeah, look at this.
That feels wonderful.
That does feel nice.
That feels really nice. Yeah.
John McKenzie, well done today. Yes, yes. And of course me, Joe Devine. We've all had a collective idea there, haven't we? It's gone to plan. I'm happy about that because that is the funniest thing that could happen. But also,
get wrecked,
at
Joe.
The same time, I'm disappointed.
This is your legacy, not being clapped at the end of this show.
Oh, I'm so proud of us as a team. We did exactly the right thing, but it hurts so much.
I thought it was going to happen to me. I'm just so proud it happened to you.
Well, thanks to producer Craig and producer Jamie as well over there. They've done a fantastic job today. And the correct thing to do would have been to clap again, but we didn't. We didn't clap, did we? No, we'll get better next time. We'll be back tomorrow with JJ Ball. And we've got some special guests coming later in the week as well. Very exciting.
Very exciting.
Also,
guests.
Look out on T4RL. You'll see a Michael Bailey special coming up, hopefully in the next few days. Very excited about that one, Michael Bailey.
Excellent.
Yes, yes. Fine. But for now, I'll feed a sane, and we shall return on the morrow.